So, by the way, Nehemiah found a viv yesterday.
Yeah, you've been grasshopping, and he found some suitable grass.
Yeah, so...
That's good.
So, it's very, very good. It lifted a stone off of everyone. We are still having the official looking, because it's something we want to bring back to life. It doesn't really matter if Nehemiah saw it today or yesterday or whatever it would be. He saw it. That's the end of it. That solves the issue. But we still want the official search to go on.
So the question is it a democratic process? Is the barley democratic? Does the majority of the barley vote in, yes, we are starting the year, or does it just have to be a patch of barley, or can it be a minority?
It has to be a reasonable patch of land. You can't just say, oh, we found one or two. You know, if you go in and you find in a field, you know, it looks as if it's really going to get there. So a week later, it's going to be Aviv, or 2 weeks later, it's going to be Aviv. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is that during Pesach itself, during Chag HaMatzot itself, we have to bring the sheaf itself. So it has to be a reasonable quantity. But even if it's a small field, then that should be enough.
Okay, so if, for example, barley in the higher, drier hills, and the barley on the lower plains, where it's maybe a bit wetter, they would be ripening at different times. You only have
That always happens. It always happens that up north it's later than down south, because down south is drier in Israel and it's hotter there.
So that's why it's a bit of a trip, because you go to where you know it's likely to be in the state of Aviv. You look there where it's more likely, rather than where it's going to be drier.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay. So another question about that, Egypt. So there is my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought there was a community of Egyptian Karaites. Is that correct?
Yes. The majority of the Karaites are from Egypt.
Are from Egypt. So do they go searching for the Aviv in Egypt?
No, the Aviv has to be searched in the land of Israel.
So we
don't care if it... Because it's very, very simple. There's two things that are very, very important to be done in the land.
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically a lot of things, you know, the temple, everything.
Of course.
The basic assumption of the Torah is that you're in the land. The diaspora is a curse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always held that sighting of the moon has to be done from the land, of Israel.
Sure.
And the barley has to be found in the land of Israel.
So which verse in the Torah would say that the barley has to be found in Israel? Because when Yehovah said to Israel...
Because it's the first of the harvest of the land. Rashit Ketzilchem. It's talking about living off the land. It's all linked. Let me explain something.
It's linked
to one another. No, it's linked to one another. You have barley coming during, being used during Pesach, mm-hmm. and then, or during Chag HaMatzot, mm-hmm. and then you have leavened bread during Shavuot.
Yes.
And then Sukkot is the Chag HaAsif, when you finish collecting every last fruit that might be in the land. It's all linked to one another, living on the land, living off of the land. So being in the land is the blessing. The good that was promised is to be in the land. So this whole theory of sighting the moon outside of the land of Israel, I would say that if you're in a diaspora and you have no connection to the land of Israel, so it works. You know, there's nothing else you can do. So if you sight the moon at a different time than the land of Israel, and the land of Israel is desolate and there's nothing here, then I think that there's nothing, no complaint could be done against you. But the moment there's people in the land, the moment that there is a way of knowing when it was sighted in the land of Israel, or when the Aviv was found in the land of Israel, I think that's a very, very important thing to still follow. I keep on getting these messages and these comments from people. I saw it where I live, yeah. and they saw it a day before.
Sure.
But the altitude and the latitude of where you are affects when you're going to see the moon. So it's not unusual, for example, to see the new moon in South Africa.
Sure.
A day before Israel, because of the positioning of South Africa.
Uh-huh.
Now, when it comes to the barley, what the Egyptian Karaites used to do is they used to send messengers to the land, and there were actually very specific locations that they went to see where it was. And I think some of the locations that Nehemiah established as the places that you go, because Nehemiah was the one who restarted, really seriously restarted. I mean, I would be surprised if here and there people were looking, but Nehemiah was the past, my guess is, over 10 years mm-hmm. has been promoting this. What was very surprising is that, for example, the first time I went, there was one point that we went and it was only a bunch of people, mostly Americans. Mm-hmm. I was one of the only Israelis in the group. These were mostly Americans who were just interested. And probably follow the biblical Bible, the biblical calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day that we went, so we had a small group of Karaites that joined, but that's because we went down south, and that was easier for them, because most of the Karaites live in basically towns, agricultural towns, in the southern part of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Or they live in Be'er Sheva and Ashdod, which is still kind of south of Israel. We had actually a small group from one of the small towns, which was purely Karaite, and now they have a lot of rabbinical Jews there. But it's like one of the towns that they actually built, which was originally one of the Karaite towns when they moved from Egypt.
Right.
So they used to send messengers, and they continued doing that for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But there was one point that they had to stop or something like that. And then when the Karaites moved to Israel in the 1950s, because they basically fled Egypt, I don't think they ever really continued doing this. And somewhere in the 1700s, they also started using some kind of a calculation.
Okay.
They developed a calculation in which someone developed a calculation by using scientific knowledge they had then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they for a while abandoned the issue of sighting the moon and going seeing the Bali and everything. But it's coming back, and there are, I mean, I've spoken with many, many Karaites from different towns, from different places that have different understandings of things, and I've noticed that slowly, slowly, they're also really seriously, like, look, okay, we really actually have to go on moon sightings and according to the Bali and everything, but there's still a large, there's a large group that actually wants to follow this fixed calendar, which is sometimes right, sometimes slightly off.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've noticed, most of the time it's right, but there are places where they make mistakes. You know, Shavuot, for example, is always right because it falls on the first day of the week. But they sometimes, for example, when they actually celebrate Yom Kippur, there was one year Nehemiah told me there was one year that the Karaite synagogue in one of the cities was open 3 days in a row,
mm-hmm.
because there was one day that people went according to the people who wanted to go according to the rabbinic calendar, and then people wanted to go according to the Karaite calendar, and then people wanted to go according to the biblical calendar. And that was kind of like a weird situation they were in.
Sure. So, well, let me just get it straight, because in Exodus 12, for example, right, we have the situation where Yehovah tells the children of Israel, and he makes reference to the Aviv, but at this stage, they're in Egypt, which is why I ask the question, because they're citing the Aviv in Egypt, saying this is when the beginning of years shall be for you. So is it wrong for the Egyptian Karaites to also cite the Aviv in Egypt as it was first done?
Well, so first of all, this is Truth to You Radio, brought by John O'Vandor, who is for some reason neglecting his obligation to introduce the people interviewing.
Let me explain it to the listeners. As is so often the case, this is what happens, right? Just I'm letting everyone know. As is so often the case, Yoel and I will get into a conversation, and then Yoel will say, "Are you recording this?" And I say, yeah, no, I'm not recording. Oh, you should be recording this. Ah, man, all of that we could have anyway. And then we'll have conversations where he says, "You're not recording this, are you?" And I say, "Yeah, I'm recording this." No, you can't. No, we can't. This is not. So anyway, here's one of the conversations that we've started, and I happen to be recording it. So let me just introduce you to everybody as if no one knows who you are. I'm talking to Yoel Ben Shlomo.
Tell the truth, I'm not too sure people even know who I am.
No, no, they do. And it so happens, because it is that time of the year, that we're talking about the Aviv and the Aviv search that you have accompanied. You accompanied Nehemiah, and you so often do accompany him on the Aviv search, right?
I've been doing this for a relatively short time. Actually going, physically going and looking at it, though, when I was growing up as a teenager, you know, I lived in an area where you walk out of my house, you walk down the road, and there's fields in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So I was aware of the issue of Bali, and I was aware of looking through the Bali and everything. And as a kid, I remember at school, this was a religious school, we were taught about the Aviv and what it means, and looking at the Bali and et cetera. I remember several times, for several years in a row, the teacher brought the Bali in and showed us and explained to us and showed us what Bali is and what wheat is, etc.
Sure.
It's actually, you know, when you speak with a rabbinical Jew and you say the Aviv, there were two things that are popping in their head. They will be thinking about spring, and they will also be thinking about the Bali.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if it's unknown. It's just not being followed. The rabbinic calendar calculates several things, and the problem is that the leap years don't necessarily always happen at the correct time. Mm-hmm. So last year, for example, happened at the correct time. There might be years when it doesn't. I remember speaking with a Karaite lady that I know, and she pointed out that, it goes according to the Bali, she pointed out there was one year that they had a leap year where the rabbinites didn't have a leap year. Right. So it doesn't always 100% correspond.
So sometimes it works out to be the same day. Sometimes it's one or two days out. Sometimes it can be one whole month out. But, you know, it does follow pretty closely for the majority of the time, I've noticed.
It's for the past 2 years, except for Yom Kippurim, like this year, Yom Kippurim. Mm-hmm. It was more or less, everything was more or less the same time. So Shavuot has a tendency never to be on the same time as the rest of, as according to the biblical calendar. The mm-hmm. rabbinic calendar, it always has to be in the sixth day of Sivan or the sixth day of the third month.
Sure.
And it, regardless, you can't say irregardless, but there's two negatives, you have to say regardless. regardless to what day of the week it is. So in the Kara calendar, it can be on the third day of the month, it can be on the sixth day of the month. So this year, for example, if we see the moon Friday night, as we hope we will, and there might be a bit of difficulty doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So Passover or Pesach is going to come out on the exact same day. Hag HaMatzot is going to be on the exact same days. And then, regardless to if it's a day later, mm-hmm. if we sight the moon after Shabbat, it will move Chag HaShavuot a week later. Because okay. the verse says, Machorat HaShabbat, the day after the Sabbath, so it's going to come out a week later.
So can we talk about... Sure, yeah, of course. So can we nut out some of the potential complications of the sighting of the moon and the sighting of the Aviv, because these are questions that are always asked. But before I get to the sighting of the moon, let me just jump back. I'm not sure that we answered the other question. The Karaite community in Egypt, because the Aviv was first sighted in Egypt.
Oh, right, yes.
Why would they not also be able to conform to that?
So again, as I pointed out earlier, that we do have the issue of sighting it in the land. Again, as I said about the moon, there is a chance, I'm not saying this is 100%, but there is a chance that if you're in a diaspora and there's no way of connecting to the people in living in the land of Israel, there's no one living in the land of Israel, so you couldn't go according to where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Again, okay. that is only an assumption of mine based on the fact that world is not a perfect world and we can have problems here and there and everywhere, and there's sure. always
If we run by that line, then obviously we run into the complication of saying, well, the Aviv is the state of Aviv doesn't happen here in the Southern Hemisphere for another 6 months or so. So that throws everybody out in all sorts of ways.
Exactly. So you're going to be celebrating Passover when it's the middle of the beginning of winter. You're going to be celebrating Passover during Sukkot.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, you know what? That would suit me down to a T, because then I don't have to be outside in spring and my nose is running, my eyes are twitching and all of that sort of stuff. I would love that. But I guess what I'm really saying is I'd love to live in the Northern Hemisphere for that reason. But let me ask you now, look, the sighting of the moon. Here's another one that I often get questions on. The sighting of the moon. You mentioned that the moon has to be sighted from Israel, even though people see the moon prior to Israel seeing the moon. Which verse are we making reference to?
Well, it's not any specific verse. It's again the issue of the understanding of the Torah itself is that the people of Israel live in the land of Israel, and diaspora is a curse. And therefore, if you're living in the land, you cite it from where you are.
But does that mean, of course, and that makes perfect sense.
It's just a logic that flows through the entire text.
Sure, but does that mean, though, that those who are already progressing into the day cannot sight the moon first, even though they see it passes over them first?
So, again, this is circular logic. Again, it's supposed to be sighted from the land. The fact that someone can see it somewhere else because of the reality of planet Earth doesn't mean that it's decided where they are. Okay,
so
The logic flows through the Bible. The only thing is that, again, if you're in a diaspora and this is the only way of calculation that mm-hmm. you have, mm-hmm. then it's probably reasonable to say this will be the way you go. But again, the understanding of the Bible is if you're in the diaspora and you're forced to live there mm-hmm. or you choose to live there, it is some kind of a curse. The Torah evolves basically from, Torah revolves around the basic thing that starts from Abraham, being in the promised land, being in this land that God promised. Sure. This is the gift of God to the children of Israel. Mm. So it just repeats itself all the time.
It does.
And I think that with all due respect to the people who say, I saw the moon, therefore I'm declaring it by myself, or I saw the moon where I live, that is a very, very problematic way to go, because what's going to happen is, I live here, I see the moon here, and it's going to create 9 million calendars. And we do see in the Bible a concept that there is a central authority.
Yes.
Now, I'm not saying that we are the authority, but that we do live in the place where the authority is supposed to be.
Yes.
Nehemiah and I never claim to be the authorities. By the way, Nehemiah is the one in charge of this stuff, not me. I'm not the expert or anything. Almost everything I know about the difficulties of sighting, I actually learned from Nehemiah. I knew about the cycle of the moon, science and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience of actually sighting it on the way that it's practically used, I actually learned from Nehemiah. Now, to remember, I used to live in a place where sighting the moon was way easier, because it was a cleaner place, the air was cleaner,
sure.
And I could see the thin moon probably easier sometimes. Probably in Jerusalem, the Christian, I could see it where I was. So I did learn about it because, I from a very young age, all Jewish children are taught to understand that that's how it's supposed to be. It's never understood. It was never understood that the calendar, the rabbinic calendar, the second calendar replaces the biblical calendar. No one's ever said that.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone says that, they're treated as if they're talking nonsense.
Sure.
Everyone knows that there's technical issues regarding. There's technical issues inside the Talmud regarding how can we reestablish it. Now, I don't see in the Bible anywhere where we need a Sanhedrin like the Talmud says.
Mm-hmm.
The moon is there. It's a fact. It's a reality. So we have three men who sit down and say it's a new moon. Whoop-de-doo. It's possible, but in the rabbinic world, they have to make everything more complex. They have to make
sure.
Life a bit more messy. And that's why, I have to understand something. This is why I have connected myself with also other people like Karaites and also Hebrew roots or Messianics, because I've come to realize that in the Jewish world, not everything is correct. I'm not thrown away. I'm not saying that, I'm not going to follow anything in the rabbinic world. People have noticed the past couple of conversations we've had, it was very rabbinic. But there are places where, with all due respect, how on earth do you conclude that this is how it has to be? Because you have a tradition, this is the way to be? So we're going to take the biblical cycle and completely ignore it because we have some kind of a tradition? It doesn't make sense. And the way traditions are dealt in the Jewish world, it's as I pointed out already in the past, it's slightly loony. And I've had my arguments with people. I was thrown out of places because of things I've said about this. We have to sometimes pack the traditions in the trunk and forget about them.
Sure, sure.
And we have to focus on what the Torah actually says.
So I have a question. The international date line, is it that you understand that the international date line is in fact Israel, maybe Jerusalem, for example, so that the sighted moon is not legitimate until it's seen from Israel? Is that possibly how it works? Is that the understanding?
So that's kind of a problematic issue, because the way time is reckoned around the world is that where you are is when you are.
Sure.
And that causes a big, big problem. So, for example, the sun sets here in Israel, say, on some day.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll take, I don't know, it doesn't really matter what day. In Japan, for example, it's already that day.
Sure.
So do we reckon time, meaning the days of the week also are reckoned based on the sighting of the moon in Israel?
It's a very good question.
And the day itself, so really time starts where we are in Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Or really time starts where you are? So this is the issue. This is why I keep on saying the diaspora is a curse.
Mm-hmm.
And it causes all these problems. There was a famous story that there was a Jewish community that celebrated Passover a day after everyone else because they made a mistake in the calculation. So it's a curse. It makes everyone's life miserable.
Makes it mathematically difficult, doesn't it? There's no doubt about that.
I mean, I've seen there have been discussions I was involved in throughout the years where what day is it really in Japan? What day is it? How do the Jews of Babylon do things? Mm-hmm. So one of the solutions is that in the diaspora, one of the solutions the rabbis found, which I think is a pretty good solution, you more or less know when something is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you know the sun, you know the moon will appear on a certain day. We have an estimate that's going to appear on that day.
Yes.
So whoever is east of Israel only waits for the declaration from Israel,
mm-hmm.
which means they have to treat that day as if it's what we think it is. So we're not changing time as in days, and we're not even changing things based on timeline. I think this, I mean, as far as I've always seen, this is probably one of the best solutions. You wait to know what happens in Israel, but you treat it as if you're in that day already. And if it isn't, so it isn't. And that's how they treated it. And that's how they dealt with it. This is why in the diaspora, for example, if you go a rabbinic Jewish synagogue, in wherever it is in the diaspora, they always have like 2 days for everything. There's 2 days of the first day of Unleavened. There's 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. By the way, there's 2 days of Rosh Hashanah all the time because of Yom Torah, because it's literally on the new moon. So that causes more problems.
Right.
So they always celebrate 2 days because there's a chance that they know that the first day wasn't really it, and then they suddenly receive message from Israel or from the Sanhedrin, if we're dealing with how it was done.
Mm-hmm.
They receive message that day and not that day, and then they know what to do. So they prevented, they stopped working, and they celebrated and everything. This is why in the diaspora also the Seder night is done twice. Because of this situation. Now, today it doesn't necessarily have to be like that, but sure. But it can happen. So I think that's the best solution. We're not changing timeline. We're not changing dates. We're not saying, oh, Israel is the center and everything evolves around. We're not saying that. At least that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, yeah, you're in Japan. It is Wednesday. It is the fourth day of the week, and you're just waiting to receive message from the land of Israel where we are, because it's never... You know, it's never 12 hours completely separate.
So it's an interesting.
It's not as if sun rises, the sun sets here in Israel, and it's ready the next day in Japan. No, we're actually more or less the same day, even after sunset.
Sure.
Presuming that sunset is what decides when the day begins.
So there's, for example, there's 9 hours between you and I at the moment, and
exactly.
and I am 9 hours in the future. And when you begin to think about that, it gets weirder and weirder. But it's interesting that you should say it's not as if Israel is the center of the universe or the center of all things. But it actually does say that in Ezekiel 5, verse 5. And what it says is, thus says the Lord God, this is Jerusalem. I have set her in the midst of the nations, or in some translations, in the center of the nations, and the countries all around her. And it's an interesting thing, because when you look at the geographical mass of the Earth, it does seem like that is literally the case. And if you another interesting thing is, if you open, for example, or just a globe, if you have a globe, or if you open Google Earth, if you spin the Earth directly around from Jerusalem, do you know what you see?
What do you see?
Ocean. All you see is ocean.
Okay.
And on the outskirts, you see New Zealand, but primarily all you see is ocean. And it is an interesting thing that directly opposite Israel is no major landmass. To have a what might be considered as an international dateline certainly doesn't go through any major continents, except for, and I find this interesting, Alaska and Canada have a border, and it seems to run very closely to that. And I'm not speculating too much on that. I just find that interesting. But that's the only one. That's the only major landmass that it seems to divide. And because if it is a literal interpretation of this verse, that that God has put Jerusalem in the midst of the nations and the countries have been set all around her, then it would make sense that she is also in the middle of the day. Therefore, if the international timeline is directly opposite her, then New Zealand and various other very small islands would be the first to experience the new day, and therefore they would see the new moon prior to Israel, 12 hours before roundabouts. See, Israel, so should it be, the question has to be asked, if Israel is in the midst of the nations, that they cannot acknowledge that new moon? So now I know that I've asked a really, really, really big question. Maybe that one's best left for the listeners and their comments on that one. Do you want to comment on that, or should we keep going?
So I'll just say, regarding the verse itself, it's not the middle, it's in the midst. It's the word betoch.
Betoch.
Be is in, toch is inside. So it's mm-hmm. using inside or in the midst of the nations, surrounded by nations, meaning yes. Israel is not. What we really have to look at the context here of the entire section, that Israel is, if you carry on to the next paragraph after, you know, the English Bibles don't have these paragraphs. The Hebrew does. Mm-hmm. It actually talks about Israel being amongst the nations, not being different than the nations, in regards to, you know, being human and everything. And the fact that it's Jerusalem doesn't mean that it gets any special treatment.
Sure.
If it sins, it sins. You know, we're the chosen people. Yeah, that's a responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're the chosen people doesn't mean, the fact that we're the chosen people doesn't mean that we can avoid punishment.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what's going on here. So it doesn't mean the middle. Though, if you take the land of Israel, this piece of land, it's actually in the center. This is where everyone was fighting over it, because whoever controls this mass of land controls the connection between Asia Minor, Europe, Asia, and Africa through the land.
Yep.
This is like the bridge in between the rest of the world and Africa.
Yes.
And Africa is still a very wealthy place: gold, silver, diamonds, everything. So. Mm. That's why it's considered to be in the middle of everything, and this is why it's such an important piece of land. Regarding the timeline, so again, I'm saying that if someone west of the land of Israel sees the moon a day before, then that's more of an issue. If someone east of the land of Israel sees it, it's less of an issue. But I think, you know, this is something, the issue of calendar is a great debate. I keep on getting, you know, friends that send me these. A comment by someone, or they send me a question, or I've seen discussions on the internet, and I have to say something very, very simple. I think that the fact that the Jewish people and all these different groups always accepted this idea that sunset is the time when we reckon the beginning of day and of the day, and sighting the moon when it just begins and not vanishing, and all these little criteria, I think that will show that the calendars, what the Jewish world uses as the calendar, is probably what they use in biblical times. And the other opinions or speculations of researchers. Now, I'm not saying, I have this thing that I use a lot of academic information, and I have a lot of academic books in my library, but I'm always very, very careful with what they're saying.
Sure.
Because one of the major problems in the academic world, unfortunately, it's also slipping into the world of people who believe in the Bible, is that they make speculations. And they have proof or don't have proof. That's an issue of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But there are places where they make pure speculations because it's like some kind of wording they find.
Yes.
For example, Roland Devaux, in his book, when he talks, he has this two-volume book about ancient Israel. And he points out, you know, the reckoning of day of time was based on the sunrise. Okay, what is your proof?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, because we always see the words day and night. Oh, it's obvious. It's not proof of anything. Let's look at the practices that we see. Let's look at the time reckoning the way the Torah describes it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Yomam Valayla is an expression which was used and had nothing to do with time reckoning of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a different layers of everything. So I'm saying we're all researching, we're all studying, we're all discovering stuff. I keep on discovering stuff, even from places that I wouldn't expect it to come from, even people that I'm seriously opposed to their opinions. It doesn't mean I don't like them. It's just I'm opposed to their opinion, and I discover new things from them as well.
Sure.
So
yeah.
The issue of the calendar, there's a lot to argue about it. There's a lot to have discussions about it. These are the types of cases where I say I'd rather just stay with the tradition I grew up with what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever discover something, you know, something very, very clear about it, then we can reopen that.
Yeah, sure. So something very clear, very compelling. Then you have reason to investigate. But you're right. It is. It can be hotly debated, particularly this time of year. You know, how do you reckon the start of the year? What kind of calendar do you keep? This, that, and the other. And, you know, it's always an interesting discussion. But, dear listeners, exercise respect for those that are exercising their integrity, because what they believe, they're doing. Whether it agrees with what you believe may be, you know, a topic of discussion, but at least they're exercising their integrity as you are. That's an important thing. So let's not, this time of year, let's not be angry at each other. However, in any case, Yoel, that the barley has been cited is what you're saying, and so it's all systems go.
I haven't seen anything by myself. Usually you need at least two witnesses for things like these. My understanding is that Nehemiah was with someone else, but we're going to have the official search anyhow. So now everyone knows when we recorded this.
Sure.
Nehemiah was nice enough to also tweet this to everyone, and he also communicated with me. There's just one thing, if people have been following a bit the Facebook thing, the Facebook Hebrew in Israel page I have, I did point out something there. How do we even know it's barley? Because the verse doesn't say barley. The verse says the beginning of your harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing the agricultural reality, the first thing to be harvested is actually barley. And I remember last year there was someone running around, took pictures of what's called green ears, and they said, we just need green ears. And the problem is that they were showing pictures of wheat, and that doesn't really fly with us. We know that it's supposed to be, you know, it doesn't say what the what has to be in Aviv, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at the relationship of Pesach, Shavuot, and then Chag HaAsif or Chag HaSukkot, we see that what's born is on Pesach is the ripened first of the harvest, which usually is barley. And then several weeks later, we see that the wheat becomes ripened and it becomes Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's born during Shavuot. If you notice, there are two loaves of bread which are leavened. So that's and most of the breads in the ancient world were actually made, what's considered the high quality breads were made from wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And the breads used in the temple were probably made from wheat.
Yeah, from real wheat.
From real wheat, the older wheat. By the way, you can still buy the old wheat. I actually noticed that Cultured Karaite.
Yes.
Has posted stuff about old wheats.
Ancient grains,
It's not really ancient grains. It's the styles of grains which were used, and there's grains which became out of style in the industrial world, but you can still buy these, and as a professional cook, I am also very aware of different types of grains, many types of grains that exist. So yes, there is ability to buy the older style of grains, which are also healthier for us, apparently. That's not something I researched yet, but thank God we now have Cultured Karaite to give us information about these things.
Amen.
So here I'm also given advertising
Cultured Karaite,
who happens to be someone I know and happens to be a friend. So
she's a lovely, lovely person. That's excellent ad placement. Thank you for that. That's the Cultured Karaite. For those who haven't heard those programs on Truth to You. So now we're going to be, we will talk about that in just a moment because Chani is making, lately she's making from spelt a sourdough, which is really good from a rye sourdough starter. You did do a program on Seor and
a year ago,
Chametz,
yes.
And Matzah. And you talked about those words in some detail, actually. So perhaps we won't revisit that. I might just put that one out again. But you know what we didn't talk about? We didn't talk about Passover. We didn't talk about Pesach. Because as soon as the year begins, you count 14 days, right?
Yeah, we count 14 days. And then you do a Passover. So how exactly was it done? So I want to first of all tackle the first issue, which is probably a major issue for many of people out there regarding when was it done?
Mm-hmm.
We both know that we've seen these opinions that how do you explain that it's done on the 14th day and it's somehow also connected to the unleavened bread, to Chag HaMatzot.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the confusion has to do with the fact that it says that in the evening of the 14th, and we're going to use the understanding in this case that the day begins in the evening.
Okay, so I just need to, just let me quickly do an explanation here. Because Yoel and I, and well, actually me and most people, have a different understanding, and that's okay.
The majority of the people hold by sunset.
Yes.
There are groups of people of who day. Believe that, exactly, and there are yes. groups of people who believe that sunrise is the reckoning of the day, though that's an Egyptian reckoning of the day, but anyhow, yeah.
As opposed to a Babylonian reckoning
of the day. In the ancient Mesopotamian world, people reckoned the day by sunset, and that is also the culture of the Torah and the Bible. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was actually the Egyptians who reckoned daytime, the day beginning from sunrise, and you can continue.
And so... And so we're not going to get dragged into that discussion again. We are going
exactly.
to be, because Yoel is my guest on the program. We are going to be approaching this from the understanding that it is reckoned from an evening to evening day, 24 hours. So go ahead, my friend, even though you're wrong.
Wait, so I you know what? I can actually be fair here to you as well, and I'll try to put both of the opinions and see how they work. Mm. Okay, so. I'm going to start off with your opinion for a moment,
wow.
which makes it even easier to understand. So sure. if we say the day begins at sunrise, mm-hmm. and we're supposed to do the Passover on the evening of the 14th, mm-hmm. there's no issue.
Sure.
On the 14th day, the sun sets, we run over, that's called Ben Arbaim, in between the evenings, mm-hmm. and I'm going to point out a few things about how the Mishnah describes how the Passover was done and how the Bible actually does it.
Sure.
But... If we go according to your opinion, it's actually easier. Basically, if we take the opinion, the sun sets, the day is not over. We still got the night.
Mm-hmm.
So going from the 14th, then the sun rises the next day. It's the 15th of the first month, and we're mm-hmm. fine. There's no dilemma. There's no issue.
Unleavened bread. It's a holiday. It's a Sabbath, right?
Exactly.
Nice.
Exactly.
Relax.
It's a Sabbath.
Chill.
You relax. Yeah. It's a festival.
Don't
You're supposed to celebrate
bread.
On festivals. Just don't eat unleavened bread. But, you know, you can do your barbecue or whatever. That's another argument, exactly the definition of what is a Sabbath of a festival and what is a Sabbath mm-hmm. of the weekly Sabbath. That's an entire issue by itself.
Sure.
But that's easy. But when day ends at sunset,
mm-hmm.
that's where the confusion begins. Because, wait, is it the 14th? Is it the 15th? What is it? So let me explain something about the concept of Ben Arbaim in between the evenings. The mm-hmm. Ben Arbaim time... is a limbo. It's in limbo.
Ooh, which Catholic means, term.
Not Catholic term. Limbo like the dance limbo.
I know.
How low can you go? So the thing is that it's a time in limbo. And that's yep. how it was treated in the Mesopotamian world. And that's how it's also treated in the Talmud. It's a time in limbo. Therefore, it can be considered part of the 14th day or part of the 15th day. Why? Why is it called the two evenings? The reckoning of time was that you have the sun set,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the setting of light on the west.
Yes, so it's quite literally, in that understanding, it's quite literally a gray area, right? Because it's twilight. So it's the fading away of light.
Exactly. It's a twilight, and it's in limbo. It's a day, a time of day which is in limbo.
It's the twilight zone.
And therefore... and then what happens is that we can still consider it the 14th day.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's another issue here. There's a cultural issue that appears in the Jewish world where we sometimes we use a different date to make sure people understand what we mean.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? If we say the sun sets and it's the beginning of the 15th day, then you will automatically understand, okay, so I'm supposed to slaughter it at sunset of the 13th day, and we do either one of two things. We eat it the same evening, or it sits around for 24 hours, and only then we eat it. And that's where the confusion began.
Sure.
So in the Jewish reckoning of time, and the way we understand the Bible, is that the sun sets on the end of the 14th day,
mm-hmm.
but we're saying it's the 14th day to make sure that you understand it's really the 15th day, and the Passover is eaten at the beginning of the festival of unleavened bread. And I know it sounds a lot more complex, so it makes more sense that your opinion.
Can I? No. But let me recap. Let me be fair to you then, and recap, and you tell me if I've got this right. I just want to make sure that we get this right so far, and then you can keep going. We sacrifice the, if we were still sacrificing, right? We'd sacrifice it between the evenings, which is when the sun goes down at the end, and this is from an evening to evening reckoning, at the end of the 13th day, at the end of the 14th day, and as the 15th begins, going into the evening of the 15th, you have the Passover meal, and then in the morning, it's the 15th daylight period of that calendar date, which is unleavened bread. Am I understanding you so far?
That's exactly what it is. And I know it sounds a lot more complex, and sometimes Occam's razor would say the simplest solution is the part of the correct solution, but that's the understanding. That is the understanding that when it says the 14th, it's basically trying to make sure that you understand it's the end of the 14th day. It's not the end of the 13th day. Mm-hmm. And that happens at least in one more place in the Torah. So that's when it's understood to be done. Now, in the Mishnah, it describes that they extended the time of the evening from basically when the sun starts setting. Sure. It's still in the heavens, so it's like around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3:30 in the afternoon. It's like two and a half hours before sunset. They would start doing the Passover sacrifice.
Not when it's on the actual or about to be on the horizon, but like a couple of hours before that time.
Exactly, okay. They extended that time. And there was probably technical reasons for it. I don't want to go into the Mishnah and everything. Mm-hmm. It's just going to mess up what we're going to be looking at the Bible itself.
Sure.
So what do we have? We also have another issue. We have the issue that in Exodus, we have a Passover.
Mm-hmm.
In Numbers, we have a Passover.
Yes.
And in Deuteronomy, we have a Passover. And we actually look at these as what Numbers of Deuteronomy represent are one type of Passover. And then Exodus represents the Exodus Passover.
The original.
And there's actually the original Passover. And there's actually several mechanical differences in between them, if I may use the mechanical.
Sure.
So what do we have? What it seems is that the non-Exodus Passover was done more as a sacrificial, but literally a sacrifice with an altar. Well, on the other hand, the Exodus Passover was done more as a family Passover. The Deuteronomy Passover is done more like a national Passover. Mm-hmm. They're both national, but the way it was treated is different.
Sure.
So how did they do it? All of this appears in the verses. It says that on the first month, on the 10th day of the first month, they are to take a lamb, or actually I think it says here a lamb specifically for each household, for each family, selabait, selabait, a lamb for each family. Now, bait necessarily means a house. It can also mean an extended family. Okay, sure. Now, if you have an entire lamb, one-year-old lambs don't have that much meat, so it's also a meal. So they say that there were not less than 10 people on each sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And they said there were cases where there were 100 people on sacrifice because that was the family.
That seems right. One lamb, 1 year old lamb to 10 people seems about right, I would think.
I would think so as well.
Yeah, otherwise, you've got little tiny bits of lamb on everyone's plate.
Exactly. And lamb chops don't have that much meat.
No.
The real meat in lamb is the on the back.
And the legs.
The sirloin and the legs, yeah. Specifically the back legs.
Yes.
So there's not much meat going on there. And I remember we actually slaughtered a one-year-old lamb a couple of years ago, and we only ate the front part of the lamb because there was a whole discussion of removing the forbidden fats and the sciatic nerve. So we forgot about it. And there was enough for meat for about 20 people, 10 men, 10 women, because these were married couples. But it was like really, you ate there and you felt as if you're lacking something.
Sure.
So I would say a one-year-old lamb is good for like 20, 30 people max.
Yeah.
Specifically, if you have men that are able to eat, then it's stretching it when you reach 30
sure.
people. So it says that they took it on the 10th day. They kept it, mishmeret, and the word shamar, to keep.
Yes.
Or to protect, in this case, they were keeping it. Mm-hmm. And then on the 14th day, they slaughtered it. But what's the difference here? There was no altar. There is an opinion by one of the Karaite scholars from hundreds of years ago that said they actually built an altar. This goes into a whole discussion regarding verses in Leviticus that talk about, are you allowed to eat, the prohibition of eating non-sacrificial meat. So he also points out then, in Egypt, they probably had an altar sitting there. Mm. I don't think that's what happened. Mm. I think they slaughtered the animal.
Yes.
And what was as if the altar was the doorposts. The door, the entrance to the house was the actual altar. They collected the blood into a vessel.
Yes.
And it says to slaughter it basaf. So a saf can be one of two things. It can be they slaughtered the animal next to the saf, which is the entrance to the house.
Yes. Yes.
Or they slaughtered the animal. And the blood was collected into a saf, which is also a cup
or sure. a bowl of sorts. And maybe both were done.
Perhaps, but it makes perfect sense what you say, because it's not as if, you know, an ocean of blood gushes out of the animal. It's a decent puddle of blood, but you want to collect it. And the other thing is that it can coagulate, depending on the temperature, but it can coagulate quite quickly. And so it would make sense that if they are about to apply the blood with the hyssop over the door frame, that it would be slaughtered as close to that point as possible. I mean, I guess that makes sense, don't you think?
Yeah, so I agree with that. And so there's several options. There's two options how to understand exactly what was done. And it says here they did in between the evenings, the entire congregation of Israel did the sacrifice. They slaughtered it and did it. So here it's less of a sacrifice. It's a sacrifice, but we don't see an altar. We don't see burning of fat. We don't see blood being taken to the altar, etc. And that actually causes doubts for me as well. Was the Passover done as an actual sacrifice in the tabernacle as well? Sure. This understanding, and when you read this, they took the cup, there was a hyssop, put the blood, marked the doors, and then they ate it. And they ate it with their shoes on and their belts on and their stuffs in their hands, basically getting ready to go, to move. We're getting out of Egypt.
Yeah.
Then what we find is in Deuteronomy, it actually tells us something else. This is, let me open it up so I have it in front of me.
Now, can I just ask a quick question? Because we use the word Passover, we use the word Pesach. I should point out that the word Passover, as well as the word atonement, by the way, for the listeners, was coined by William Tyndale in his translation of the Bible. And he used the word Passover because God passed over and obviously took out the firstborn of Egypt. Now, does the word Pesach carry the same definition?
So there's different things. It says that ki pasach Hashem al batei avotecha mitzrayim. So it's like Passover. It can also mean like the word Piseach, which is in the PL, which means the person who drags his leg. So it's an issue of skipping a step or skipping over something. So Passover would probably be an accurate interpretation of it.
Interesting. Okay, nice.
So we have Deuteronomy 14, and in verse 2, it says that you do tzon uvakal. You actually bring not only sheep, but also cattle, which is an interesting issue. Because in the Jewish understanding, the practice in the Second Temple was that you actually bring only sheep or goats. And here we see that tzon uvakal, basically any edible cattle and livestock that you have. What happens is, first of all, we have an additional section. Now, there's been an argument about this, because in the rabbinic world they say, oh, it's only sheep and goats. So then we have this verse. So there's actually a verse in Chronicles, and one of the Passovers done in the Book of Chronicles, that it says that they brought sheep, goats, and cattle, but it mentions something about also the kodashim, the holy ones or the holy sacrifices. So that someone actually said that maybe this was an adjustment in the Second Temple period to try to explain whoever wrote Chronicles was trying to explain how is it that there also cattle was brought. So you said, oh, there was some other sacrifice done there. This is a very, very complex discussion. We're not going to open it up, but just be aware that it exists.
Mm.
But what's very important here, it says that this is in Deuteronomy, it says that it's no longer a personal home sacrifice that you can do in your backyard or in front of your house. It actually has to be done at the temple.
Yes.
So instead of becoming family, though it seems that the family eats it, it becomes a sacrifice that's done by the entire nation at the temple.
But in the temple. So now we're in Deuteronomy 16, right? So this is so it says, verse 5, I'll just read it. You may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates which Yehovah your Elohim gives you, but at the place where Yehovah your Elohim chooses to make his name abide, there you shall sacrifice the Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt, and you shall roast it and eat it in the place which Yehovah your Elohim chooses, and in the morning you shall return and go to your tents.
Exactly. So we see this, and I've heard of people who are doing an imitation of it or something, but I've also heard of people who actually are doing a Passover sacrifice. So this verse in Deuteronomy actually shows you're not supposed to be doing that. So that's regarding the time and place of the Passover sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, eating it itself, I don't think that, or I'm not too sure if they actually did it exactly the same way they did in Egypt, but I remember looking at something and it struck me as fascinating was when I looked at how the Samaritans do it.
Mm-hmm.
They all go to the place of sacrifice. They do their Passover on Mount Gerizim,
mm-hmm.
and they wear their ceremonial clothing, but they make sure they wear their shoes as if they're fully dressed, waiting to leave somewhere, basically reenacting the original Passover of Exodus.
Yeah.
And I saw actually very old pictures of it, and originally what they did was they would all eat it in the same place, at the place of the sacrifice. So if I have it right, and if I look at the Book of Chronicles correctly,
mm-hmm.
the Passover was eaten at the area of the temple as close as possible. People didn't really go back to their houses. Now, this is me connecting different dots in the Bible. But it looks as if the way Samaritans used to practice it and something they still kind of practice it was an overnight thing.
Mm-hmm.
It started at sunset, and that's how they practice it as well. They do it at sunset.
Yes.
But their time reckoning as well is the same way Jews do.
Yes. Yeah.
At sunset, the day begins.
Mm-hmm.
They start the sacrifice and they roast it, and then they give the portions out to the different people, and then. They all eat it, kind of like they take it to the houses, but it's like an overnight thing. It's done close to where the temple is.
Yeah, yeah. In the second temple period,
it had to be eaten inside Jerusalem, inside the city of the walls of the mm-hmm. city. Mm-hmm. But what it looks in Chronicles is that they also partially ate it in the area of the temple. So it looks as if in the Temple Mount in the immediate area, and if I'm reading Chronicles correctly, they actually sat to eat, the families eating the Passover sacrifice. So as if it's like a communal meeting, the entire congregation of Israel meeting with God at the temple, renewing the history of the people and renewing this action of this is how we became a nation.
Yes.
At the temple itself, eating the sacrifice in the immediate area of the temple.
Brilliant. I really like that.
That might have been the way it was done. And the Samaritans used to do exactly the same. When it became dangerous for them to be outside at nighttime because of the Arabs,
mm-hmm.
then they started going to the houses. But I've seen pictures from the 1920s where you see Samaritans sitting with large plates with the portions of the meat,
mm-hmm.
and they're outside. They're not inside houses. They're outside in the area of their altar.
It's certainly curious, isn't it? Have you attended a Samaritan Passover sacrifice?
So I've never really attended. I drove. They do it on Mount Gerizim, and this was on a Friday, and it happened to be that on that day we went to the place where we used to see the Joseph's tomb, because the access to it is very limited. At that time, you couldn't go there at all.
Right.
And we drove through. It was a Friday, so we saw some of it. But you can see videos of it on YouTube. There's many, many videos you can see on YouTube of the Samaritan Passover with all different stages. There's also slideshows on YouTube that you can see the different stages, also pieces of video. And I think that kind of represents what was done now. But what's very interesting about the Samaritans, and they do a few other extra things. They actually are reenacting the Exodus, because what you see there, they do several things. They go around and they put blood on the doorposts.
Mm-hmm.
And there are also men that put blood on their forehead to be a sign in between their eyes. That's kind of like an over-literalization of certain things, but I think that it's an interesting thing to see.
Yeah.
Now, so we have the time, we have the place, we have more or less how it was actually done.
Sure.
So it was an overnight thing, and then people in the morning, or maybe children fell asleep, etc., maybe women, and sometimes men will fall asleep. Though men have, there's an interesting tendency amongst men to stay up very late at night.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a women as well, but I've seen mostly with men.
Sure.
So we have time, place, and how it was actually done. Now, it's supposed to be eaten with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. So the word for it is maror. And maror, or merorim, being the plural, merorim, actually, maror is it could contain a whole list of things. Basically, anything which is bitter. I've spoken with people who eat different kind of herbs you can buy in the supermarket, and it's all good. It's all leafy substances which are good. The classic one done amongst Jews is lettuce. If you ever had real Arabian letters, it's pretty bitter.
Okay.
It's kind of it's really bitter, and it's a classic one used by Orthodox Jews. European Jews also use parsley root, which is not bitter, just tastes ghastly. It's really tasty when you cook it, when you boil it, and to get all the bitterness and whatever makes it really harsh. But in general, that's not bitter herb. That's not maror.
Okay.
So it's any leafy substances that you might eat. And the main focus here is really the meal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the reenactment of the sacrifice. Now, traditionally, so we're going to start describing a bit what a Seder night will look like. Traditionally, we say, "V'higata levincha bayom ha'u le'mor b'avur zeh asad Adonai tzitim b'tzitim Mitzrayim," and you shall tell your son on that day, for this, probably the sacrifice that he's doing, that for this, or because of this, I am doing this worship of God.
Mm-hmm.
So really the practice is to tell the story of the Exodus as well. The child looks, okay, why are we all here at night eating this poor little lamb that we just eat with these herbs and this funny bread? Now, by the way, in the ancient world, unleavened bread was also the bread of the poor. So it's also referred as lechem oni, a poor man's bread, or bread of poverty. And it was actually not uncommon to eat it, but you have meat and you have this unleavened bread, the poor man's bread, and poor people usually didn't have the ability to eat meat. So there's obviously something strange going on here. So child goes like, what on earth is going on? So the father starts telling him, we were slaves in Egypt, and he tells the story.
Sure.
So the family sit there and they talk about it. Now, another interesting practice which appears in the entire Jewish and Samaritan world is reciting verses of praise. And the Samaritans do the exact same thing. So what happens is that you're enacting this and you suddenly realize what happened and how amazing it was. You're trying to reach a point where, or at least the way it's done in the Jewish world, you're trying to reach a point where there's a climax, and suddenly you start reciting verses of praise. And basically in the rabbinic Seder night, you reach a point where you start reciting what's called the Hallel, or the verses from Psalm, was it 113 to 118, I think, or 117.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about this when we spoke about the Siddur.
Yes.
And you reach a point where you want to thank God and glorify Him and praise Him, and you're trying to reach this point where there's this climax where you realize what happened, and the child realizes what happens, and then everyone starts singing these psalms.
Yes.
That's really what the Seder night is. Now, in the rabbinic world, the Seder night it's kind of complex, different stages, but it's really an imitation of a Greco practice, a Greek practice of what's called a symposion, which was a meal where you had cups of wine and you spoke and you had people pouring you wine, because the practice is that they had someone whose job was to pour the wine. And it's kind of leaning on your side. The way it's done is most of the time you're leaning on your side, specifically when you're drinking the wine, and you're talking and you're hashing over the story and everything. Mm. And it is exactly the same way the symposion was done. And the reason the rabbis decided they're supposed to look at the symposion is because they wanted to take what was considered to be a free the actions and the practices of free people, because we were taking our bondage into freedom. So they said, this is a symbol of freedom amongst us. So you don't really have to do it today. I don't. Even when I sit with rabbinic people, I tell them, you know, really, this is a rabbinic thing that, you know, doesn't, we don't really feel comfortable leaning on our side, and it has no meaning in our world. So sure. We don't really need, I don't think we really have to do it. So there were rabbis in Europe specifically who said, no, you just sit on a chair. You don't have to incline. You have to lean on your side, because they said it has no meaning in our world. We don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We should choose other symbols. So, for example, I don't know, free people. So we don't really have slaves today, at least not in the modernized world. There is slavery, unfortunately. But so maybe the best way to express this is, first of all, let's cling to what the Torah actually says.
Mm-hmm.
So have the unleavened bread, have your bitter herbs. There's still a practice of the Jews of Rome to actually have lamb on the table. There's actually a lot of families today. The Roman Jews used to have an entire roasted lamb on the table. I actually have a friend from Rome who told me that that was their practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of families, even from other places around the world, usually have lamb on the table to represent the sacrifice, but it's never done as a sacrifice. You go to the supermarket, you buy a piece of meat. You don't take a lamb and start doing the actual thing.
No. But you can obviously memorialize the slaughter of the lamb and have lamb that night. I think, you know, I'm all for any excuse to have lamb.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the way lamb was done by certain people, but there's amazing ways to do lamb. But the thing is, if we want to re-commemorate, we have to make sure it's roasted. But there are very good ways to roast it. You know, I don't see any. I don't think there was a problem with roasting it with spices and stuff. You know, it's like roasted meat and that's it. It will be tasteless. So maybe, you know, you can make it, you know, pour in it, marinate it before you do it. And maybe that's what they actually did. There's actually a mission that sort of speaks about that. First of all, you're not supposed to cook it. Cooking basically in water or eating it raw, you make sure that you roast it. But I don't know if there's any issue of roasting, if there's a problem roasting it with spices and stuff like that.
I'm happy to put up my hand and say that we roast ours with garlic and rosemary and a little bit of olive oil. Yum.
Yeah, so I actually think that lamb goes very, very well with mint.
Yes, and mint.
And I would actually do it with lemon juice and mint, but that's me.
All right, now I'm going to give that a try. Lemon juice and mint.
And there's different things. I mean, if you don't keep the difference in between meat and milk, there's like amazing dairy sauces or dairy cheeses that you can mix in with mint and eat it with a lamb. There's stuffing you can do, the lamb loins, are just amazing.
Oh, you can amazing. do a minted yogurt as well. Oh,
exactly.
Right. You're making me hungry.
You can make a sazeki, which is a Greek yogurt, which is pretty amazing as well. Again, that's besides the sacrifice itself, besides the meat itself.
Mm.
So that's like little tips here and there make your evening interesting. But that can be a symbol of being a free person, that your meal, that you're sitting there and it's like really nice. You're not
really
sitting there with your crummy cutlery and everything. No,
everything
sure
is
that,
special, and you've got the liberty to be able to sort of splash out a little bit and make it a special night because you're commemorating something of utmost importance. And so you've got your lamb, you've roasted it, it's looking good, it's succulent, you've got your bitter herbs to go along with that, you've got the unleavened bread, and you've got the wine. Now, the wine,
the four cups is also again part of the symposium. You don't actually need that. And by the way, you should know there are Karaites, for example, who will not drink wine because wine is fermented. I don't agree with that for one very simple reason, because the Torah says you're not supposed to bring honey and se'ol, which is the fermented substance, which can also mean fermented bread, which means we're talking about leavened bread. You're not supposed to bring that except for the todah, which is a sacrifice which is bought with leavened bread, and the two Thanksgiving breads which were bought during Shavuot. But on the other hand, we find wine on the altar.
Yes.
So wine is not leavened. So this is part of a discussion I actually saw. So we go back a bit a year ago about the other discussion we had. Wine is not leavened. Wine is fermented. And there's actually, chemically, there's not much of a massive difference in between fermented wine or wine, basically, and leavened bread. The difference is that leavened bread is what's forbidden, not the fermentation process.
And if I recall what you said last year, I think it came down to the fact that wine is made from grapes and bread is made from grain, and the leavening or the yeasted process, the leavening process, a process that happens with grain is quite different, distinctly different from that which happens with fruit and grapes, for example. Is that fair?
There are differences. There's things on the chemical level that we spoke about, but essentially there's a massive difference in between them, and it's not something which is fermented. It's something which is leavened, which means leavened bread. So there's a massive difference. But there are Karaites who will not touch wine during Passover. But on the other hand, the rabbinic world, drinking four cups of wine, and I prefer grape juice. But I'm not a big fan of alcohol in general.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that, unless it's beer, by the way, beer I like. But for example,
but we can't
beer,
have beer, can we? We can't have beer because
exactly,
it's actually fermented
beer,
with grain.
It's fermented grain, exactly. It's fermented grains. But the thing is that there's four cups of wine in the Seder night, and that's also part of the symposium. So if you don't want to drink the wine, you don't have to. There's no need for it.
Fair enough.
Because it's not part of what's described in the Bible as a practice. So really, the Seder night, there's no real Seder night, because the word Seder means an order. And the Seder night has this, there's this list of things supposed to do one after the other. Mm-hmm. And everyone sits there waiting, for, when are we going to get to the meal? Mm-hmm. Because you wash your hands twice, and you eat the matzah, and you do this, and you do that. Yep. And by the time you reach the meal, you're half dead. And this is why... And this is why I personally prefer it. You can start there, and you haven't, again, the practice in the rabbinic world is you can't have anything leavened until from around something like 11 o'clock in the morning. We stop having to make sure we don't make mistakes.
Sure.
And so everyone's starving because specifically if you're a European Orthodox Jew, there's not much you can eat because there's certain other really, really stupid prohibitions which were developed. I'm calling them stupid. I stopped practicing this stuff when I was 18. The moment I was out of my father's house, I started ignoring this practice. But it's an issue of not eating anything which is a seed, which means he can't eat rice, he can't eat any other grains which not ferment, he can't eat any legumes, you can't eat anything. So you're sitting there, you're starving. And for European Jews during Passover, during Hagamatzot, there's only potatoes, carrots, fresh vegetables, and fruits, and that's okay, but you don't eat rice, you don't eat anything that's a carbohydrate, makes you feel full, and potatoes are not really good for you. Mm. So a lot of people gain weight during a lot of European Jews gain weight during Passover. You know, no corn, no, nothing. You're just starving. So by the time you reach the Seder night, you're sitting there, you're half starved, and because you know how to eat a matzah as well. There's a lot of stuff I can describe about the rabbinic world. I'm just going to completely try to ignore it as much as possible.
Okay.
By the way, that's a contradiction. Completely ignore it as much as possible. It's kind of contradictory, but we're gonna try to ignore what's done in the rabbinic world. So you're starving, and sure, this whole ceremony until you reach the food, and then when you're eating, just stuffing your face. What I think was actually done was this was a meal. Unlike the way it's done in the rabbinic Seder night, this was a meal. Mm. You actually sit there and you tell the story to your children. You talk about it. You hash it over while eating. And I remember the first time I went to a Yemenite Passover Seder, and it was completely different. There was food on the table. There was everything. You just nibble through. You do the blessing of the wine, and the moment you start eating the matzah. Then you start telling the story because it's Kadesh Ulchatz. I'll give the list. It's Kadesh Ulchatz, Karpas Yachatz, Magid Rachza Mutzi Matzah, Morok Orech Shulchan Orech, I can't remember it. Morok Orech Shulchan Orech, I don't remember it now. Wow, I haven't been using it for years. I don't remember it. We'll find it. Don't worry. We'll find it. Please cut this out. So there's this whole Seder. So they actually were nibbling through, and I'm like, great, I'm adopting this.
Yeah.
But since I got married, we just do it that way. We do the kiddush, we do this, we run through a whole bunch of stuff, and we actually go into the issue of telling the story while we're already eating.
Excellent.
So we do that, and I think that's how it was done, because the main point here is the sacrifice of the meat and the eating of the vegetable or the leafy substance and the matzah itself. So they used to tell the story while eating. And when you're starving, it's very difficult to be happy and celebrate.
So
you know,
yeah,
so
that's true.
It's completely irrational the way it's done.
So I think last year we did something similar, and I do recall. I think we went to karaitcorner.org, and that's karaitcorner with a K, karait-corner.org, and I do believe we found a karait Passover seder. That we went through as we went through the meal, and as I recall, I think it was just absolutely beautiful.
It's lots of verses. This makes it organized. The whole idea of this of the Haggadah, the word lehagid is to say, the Haggadah is the saying, is really just a way of organizing. The same thing as the Sidur. It's just a way of organizing. If you don't know what to do, you have something to tell, like a manual of how to do it. Mm-hmm. But really, I mean, I don't use a Haggadah. I haven't used a Haggadah in years. And what I do is I just start telling the story. You open up the Tanakh, you go over it. I mean, I remember, for example, last year I did my Seder night, and it felt the same night the Karaites did.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my Seder night with my kids, and I made a whole show for them to get them interested and talking with me. But it goes into the evening, so by something like 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening, we're done. They were falling asleep. So I told my wife, okay, now I'm running to Nehemiah's house. And she said, okay, toodaloo. And I ran to Nehemiah's house, and I walk in, and there's a whole bunch of people there that some of them I knew and some of them I met the same night. And there's food on the table. And what are they doing? They're sitting there with their Bibles, and they're telling the story of the Exodus.
Excellent.
And they're talking about it. And this went on for hours. And I sat there. I remember I went to sleep like 2 o'clock in the morning that night.
Yeah.
And I also had a very, very nice conversation with a man I met that night called Joe Dumont.
Ah,
and,
Joe, yeah.
Yeah, that's when I met Joe. And thank God I get to meet him basically every festival when he comes to Israel. He knows where I am now. He knows how to find me.
Lovely
we
guy.
Have our phone numbers. Yeah, wonderful guy, great guy.
Mm.
And I met him that night. And that's what they were doing. And I'm sitting there, and there's a whole bunch of Karaites there, and they're talking. And I'm just sitting there listening and chit-chatting. And the main issue was to tell the story. And I think that's really what you have to do. So you don't really have to use a Haggadah. Haggadah is just making it organized.
Mm-hmm.
But truthfully, if you're talented, you'll find a way of doing it. I remember last year, what I did with my kids is I dressed up in a robe. Mm. And I had a staff in my hand. And I had my shoes on, but we laid there, and I did a whole bunch of like a whole show for the kids, telling them the story. And then I run to the room, and the moment I was, you know, we were telling about the plagues. So I was like, you know, I don't know, I brought some colored water and showed them this is what blood looks like, and cool. Whatever it be. And I have a little thing that looks like locust. My wife bought me this little pin that looks like a locust, so I brought that to the table and showed him how it hops, you know, and whatever it is. And then when we reached the Exodus itself, I ran to the room and I filled up a pillowcase with stuff, and I said, no, I'm leaving, and I opened the door and walked out. You know, you just do a show, and it really depends on who they are.
Look, I remember a couple of years ago that we reenacted it as we led up to the evening, and this is just before dinner, and I think, if I remember correctly, I think that the chickens were in the chicken coop. They were the Israelites in captivity. And then we had the dog was the Egyptian firstborn, I think. And we didn't actually kill the dog.
But it says, Lochagatz kelev leshono. Dogs were actually told that they were good. They didn't bark.
Yeah, they did. Well, my dog wasn't obedient that particular night. But then, you know, then the firstborn was killed, and we let the chicken door open, and all the chickens came out and were set free, and they were... And off they went.
Led by Chicken Moses.
Let my chickens go. And so, you know, you can have fun with it. If you've got some kids, I mean, by all means, use some props and make it interesting for them. And we had a great time.
And if the kids are older, or you're already all adults, so you have an intellectual discussion about it and try to understand the text and what exactly happened. Or, I don't know, talk about archaeology that's been discovered. You know, just bring it to life. Sure. Whatever suits you. This is the one thing that I find... very, very important. The practices of the Torah are specific. There are rules and there are regulations, but beyond those rules, you know, if you're not breaking those rules, everything's open.
Sure.
So, you know, there's nothing specific that you have to do. I mean, I have a brother-in-law who's Kurdish, and they have really amazing, sometimes funny practices when it comes to the Passover. And I sat with him several times, and there was this one point, you know, there's an issue of kids fall asleep, so it was one point. He came to the table with a whole pile of green onions and started smacking people over the head with it.
What?
And I'm standing there like, what on earth are you doing? And he said, this is one of the ways that in Kurdistan, they made sure the children stay awake and they're having fun. And my kids had a great time. They grabbed the onions, they're running around the table, hitting their grandfather and hitting their dad and hitting whoever with these green onions, and specifically pinpointing the guy who brought the green onions to the table, getting his children to attack him as well. And that woke them up, and they were like awake, and they were able to go through it like 10, 11 o'clock at night.
Sure, wow.
So that's another thing, though. The main point here is to pass on the information.
Hmm.
And that's really what it is. And I want to touch on one last thing.
Please.
That hopefully you'll be able to put into the recording.
Mm.
The one last thing I want to point out is there's an interesting verse in Exodus that talks about the laws of the Passover. And it says here in Exodus 12,
yes,
verses 43 all the way to verse 50,
circumcision.
It talks about circumcision and stuff like that. And there was something pretty interesting. I've read this many, many times, and I know what the Hebrew means. And then, you know, I'm sitting there, and I get an email from Nehemiah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty amazing that you can read something for years and never notice it. I get an email from Nehemiah, and there's like a little short essay he writes about the Passover and conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it, and literally my jaw drops to the table, my working desk. And I go, oh, God, I've never noticed this. What? I read it again, and I'm like, wow. And I go over the verses, and I'm looking at verse 48, and it says, that if a surgeon will sojourn with you, and he shall do a Passover to God, he has to circumcise all. I'm not translating, I'm just paraphrasing it. He has to circumcise all the males, and then he will come close, or he will bring the sacrifice to do it, and then he will become ke'ezrach ha'aretz.
Okay, so before you explain what that means, let me read from my translation. This is Exodus chapter 12, verses 48 to 49. And when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One Torah, one law, shall be for the native born and for the stranger who dwells among you. What does it mean?
So, yes, this is a very, very important passage. It actually tells you that it kind of gives you an idea of also what Passover is. So from this, I understood that this is the process of conversion. The person is a stranger, a ger, and then by doing the Passover, he becomes a citizen of the land.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also the conversion. And it was pretty surprising for me, because conversion in the Jewish world is a completely different process. And this is it. So this is the final stage of the conversion. And it kind of gives you an idea also what the Passover is. It's when you become the nation. You become the nation of Israel. So by doing the Passover, a person also becomes of Israel.
Amen.
It's as if we were all converted to becoming Israel when the first Passover was done.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gives you kind of an idea of what it is. So we're reenacting several things, including becoming this nation called Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So this was something that was a big surprise for me when Nehemiah showed me this. And now I go around to the people, this is the real conversion.
Yes.
You know, and today that we don't have it. So I personally think the conversion is accepting the God of Israel as your God and just starting doing the Torah. Going through this whole, obviously if you're a man, circumcision and everything.
Mm.
But by deciding, making the decision to be in covenant, you do become part of the people of Israel. But as I pointed out, and this was a big, there were a lot of comments on this one, but I don't think that if you're sitting on some kind of side of a mountain and you're completely separated, that you really are part of Israel. I think that you have been converted. Okay, this was 6 months ago, and I've continued studying this stuff.
Mm.
I think you are converted, but I think it's very, very, very important that you do connect with Jewish people, that you do affiliate yourself with the Jewish people to make sure that you are inside this thing called the nation of Israel.
You're actively participating in some
exactly.
kind of sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you have a congregation and the entire congregation is in agreement, so it's a congregation of Israelites now.
Mm-hmm.
The conversion itself, I keep on saying this to people, and I'm very surprised that I get these really angry responses about this. And I keep on telling people, no, I think that the moment you decide that you want to be in the covenant with the God of Israel, that's it. That's your conversion. That's mm-hmm. really what can be done today. But people have this tension that they want to say that they're descendants of Israel. And I keep on saying it doesn't matter, even if you're not. You know, if you are the 10 tribes, not the 10 tribes, it doesn't matter. The fact remains that we don't know 100% who you are. But the moment you decide to become Israel, that's it. The door's open. Welcome.
As the
Arabs say,
Tfadda. That's right. That's right. And so, and of course,
doors open.
So, observing the Passover post circumcision, that as you say, is the final step in your conversion process, and there you are.
Exactly.
I like that.
And that's my opinion today. I mean, I was strongly opinionated that you have to do all the whole process and everything. And I think, you know, the conversion in the rabbinic world was done to be complex. Because it was complex because of reality reasons they had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They had a lot of non-genuine people and stuff like that. Yeah. That's why they made it really complex. But it's really not that difficult. And really the issue is the moment you open up your heart to God of Israel, that's it. He's going to say, you're welcome in. Now you're one of my children.
Excellent. And if only they did recognize that for Aliyah, then things would be a lot easier. But until then, this is the reality that we find in the Torah. So I thank you for ending it there. I think that is an excellent place to end it. Yoel Ben Shlomo, my friend, thank you for sharing with us about the Aviv, of course, but also about some of the finer points of Pesach, Passover. Hebrew in Israel is the page. You can find it on Facebook. Get there, like it, and there's a lot of information there. No doubt you'll be sharing some information over the Passover period and Unleavened Bread. And I will be posting as well the interview that you and I did almost a year ago on...
By the way, that was our first... That was the first time...
It was the first interview. One, wasn't it? Yeah, it was
and
the first.
And the reason I was in that interview, I'll tell the secret here,
go on.
Is that Nehemiah was busy with something else... And he had the time, so he calls me up and he says to me, there's this guy in Australia called Jono, and he has this radio station, and we need someone to talk about Chag HaMatzot. Can you please do it? And we started talking, and then I did it, and that was the kickoff. So we've actually known each other for about a year as well. So we're celebrating a year as well of knowing
each
other.
That's true. I didn't even think of that. We are too. And you've been an absolute blessing, let me say, in the entire year let me take this opportunity to say you are an incredible blessing to myself, to the listeners, and I just want to thank you once again for being on Truth to You, my friend.
It's my pleasure to share. I realized one day, being nagged by a lot of friends from the U.S., from the Hebrew roots, and from, you know, they say, you know so much, you have to start teaching. I remember friends were saying, you become a rabbi one day, and I said, nah, and I'm not a rabbi. But I realize how important it is that people like me will go on, because I come from a completely different perspective than the Karaites do, though I do know what Karaites in certain situations things say. And I would say something very interesting. I posted something on my Facebook, and there's this man there, and it's not the first time, but it kind of encourages me to continue, because you have your breakdowns with the Messianics and Hebrew roots and whoever, you know, people who want to follow Torah, and there's disagreements and everything. And you get encouragement because someone suddenly sends to you, I've been praying, and this is not the first time I get this. I've received several messages, either an email or people will call me and they say, we've been praying for someone to help enable us to know what goes in the Orthodox world. It's the same question. How does it feel to be an answer for a prayer? And the answer is, I'm just gobsmacked when that happens, because I did not realize the impact of what people like me do, or any other teacher do, until you get this email. When you realize you're not just standing there interviewing to a radio, it actually goes out there and people hear it, and in many cases it helps. So the answer is amazing. The feeling is amazing that you're able to help, and you're able to spread knowledge, and helping people get closer to the God of Israel. And even if you don't 100%, even if there's not 100% agreement, the purpose here and is exactly the same. We all want to understand the Torah. Amen. And this is why it breaks my heart when people start arguing.
Yes.
And in a violent way, not in just trying to understand.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to say, and thank you to the listeners for that kind of feedback, because we really do appreciate it. I'm going to say one final thing, and that is the very first conversation you and I had, you know what, I never have forgotten it, and I'll tell you why, because it was during a time, and you'll remember it, and we won't go into detail, but it was during a time when certain sects of the Messianic world, if you like, or Hebrew world, or Nazarim, or whatever they were calling themselves, were exercising some vicious, I will say, vicious attacks upon Nehemiah Gordon, quite unfounded and really quite distasteful. And it was during that time that I was just disgusted at some of the things that were going on from some people. And it was at that time that you and I had a conversation, and you, an Orthodox chap, said to me, in closing of our conversation, you said, you are welcome in my sukkah anytime, is what you said. And that just was one of the most impacting things that I've ever heard. And I can't even begin to tell you what that meant to me at that time, and what that demonstrated to me at that time. And I even get, I tell you, I get teary just thinking about that now. And so that is the man that you are. I thank you for being on Truth to You. We've now done a year. I look forward to another year, my friend. And to the listeners, just have a wonderful, blessed Pesach, have a wonderful Passover and unleavened bread. And until we speak again, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kol Tov. Pesach kasher v'sameach. Kosher and happy Passover.